Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program, hour number two. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with John Nesbitt. He is probably best known for a book that he published back in 1982, that book, Megatrends. It was an international bestseller and established him as one of the world's leading futurists. Since then, he has published a number of other books, has done a lot of consulting work for large corporations, and has done a lot of speaking about forecasting trends in the economy, in business, in technology, in popular culture. And he says that one of the questions that he is most often asked is, how is it that he goes about working to identify some of these key global trends? Well, he has a new book out in which he lays out a number of principles, ways of thinking, things that he call mindsets, that he says can help to identify some of these future trends. The book has just recently been published. It's actually in two major sections. The first deals with these mindsets, these ways of thinking, and then the second half of the book has to do with some predictions he makes about forecasts he makes for the future in a number of areas, including culture and economics, looking at the future economic potentials of China and Europe. And we'll talk about some of those things here this morning in this hour with John Nesbitt. He has authored a number of books, including Reinventing the Corporation, Megatrends 2000, High Tech, High Touch, published in 1999. He has been an executive with both IBM and Eastman Kodak. He served as Assistant Secretary of Education in the Kennedy administration, then was a special assistant to President Johnson. He has been visiting fellow at Harvard, visiting professor at Moscow State University, and is now on the faculty at the Nanjing University in China. He is joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. All we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief. That'll help us to keep the program moving and get in as many different callers as possible. Callers certainly, though, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Nesbitt, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, nice to be on your program. Thank you for having me.
We'll try and talk about a number. I want to try and talk about a number of the mindsets, a number of these points. Even if we talked about everyone for only a couple of minutes, that would be a big chunk of time. So maybe I just might pick a couple of things to at least start out with. And I think that there are several here that, in a sense, kind of hang together that have to do with how we think about the pace of change. And I think that they're good things for people to keep in mind. And basically, the points I'm thinking of, the very first one, in which you argue that while it is true that a lot of things around us change, most things don't. One of the later points is that when we do think about change and what we expect to happen, it never happens as fast as we think. It always happens more slowly. And maybe one further that I'll kind of fold in here, and that is, as you're thinking about what's going to happen in the future and you're trying to make these kind of statements about trends, you really have to look at what is going on now. And I think it would be true, you can tell me if it's right or not, that sometimes changes do happen that are so completely surprising they seem to come out of nowhere. But most of the time, when you look at what's happened, you might say to yourself, well, you know, I guess I really should have been able to, I should have kind of seen this coming. If I was paying attention to the right things, I would have seen this coming. Maybe we can sort of mush all that together and you can say some things about that.
Of course. Well, the first one, that while many things change, most things remain constant. I think that's true, and I think if one thinks about it very long, it becomes clear. But the confusion is that change is the currency of the media, and we get so bombarded with change, with things that have changed, because that's the only thing that's news, that we really do get confused about it. And you have such mantras in business as the only constancy in business is change, which is absolutely ridiculous. Most things don't change in business. Most things are the same since the 40 years I've been involved. Buying and selling is the same. making a profit is a necessary condition of survival. This is same and so on. But the constancy has to do, and we all experience this, with our own lives, our own families, our family, our children, sending them to school, our religion, our work, sports. These things are all very constant. These are the bedrocks, and, you know, change sort of bounces off these constancies, and we have to pay attention to that. But it is not that the only constancy is change.
Hmm. It is the case, I'm sure, that there are things that some people would point to as saying there were particular developments that caught most people unawares. I mean, is it? Do you think it really is the case that most things that are surprising, that seem to be surprising developments, would have been the things that if one had been paying attention to the right early signs, you could see that, and it's not really the case that things that big developments, surprising things, really just come out of nowhere.
Well, yeah, one of the mindsets is that the future is embedded in the present, and if you think about that, that's not startling. I mean, the seeds of what is going to occur are with us today. They're all around us. The trick is to discover or to identify the things that really do flower and become part of the future, and the things that are just blips on the screen or just noise in the air. But things don't appear, you know, out of the vapor full blown. They start and they begin, and the beginnings of all the change that we're going to see, whatever it is, are with us right now. And that's why I say that the future is embedded in the present.
Well, given that, as you say, and I think that it is true that often change is hyped, that we spend too much time talking about the relentless pace of change and how things are going faster and faster, and sometimes it's difficult to separate what might be a fad, what might be the blip, you know, from something that actually is representative of a big and a significant development. How do you particularly sort up from among those things and try to sort the blips from the major changes?
Well, I use another one of the mindsets, and that is to see the future as a picture puzzle. If you take those things that are candidates to be a blip or candidates to be something in the future, and you see them as pieces of a puzzle, and you start to look at them, and you see those that are related to other things, and as you put them together, just as a picture puzzle, and you start to see a picture being formed, you know, then you start to see things that are going to happen out ahead of us. If you take something else and it stays in isolation, it doesn't seem to fit with anything else, then you know that for sure that's just a blip on the screen. So see the future as a picture puzzle is one of the mindsets.
Hmm. There's another thing here that I think is important and perhaps often we overlook. This is the one that you say focus on the score of the game. And this is the thing to my mind, what you're actually talking about here is you're saying, you know, look for data, look for hard data. Don't rely on, you know, if there's politicians talking to you about the economy, don't rely on them telling you that it's great. Or if there's a business person, some CEO is telling you that everything's going great in their corporation, well, that's fine that they're telling you that it's great. Or for anything else that you're talking about, look for numbers, look for things that can really tell you what's going on, because they can't be fudged. I don't know, maybe they can be fudged, but it's harder. Yeah, when we're talking about real data.
Well, David, that is just right, and my standard for this is sports. You know, I don't know about people listening, but I always read the newspapers back to front, because partly because sports are usually in the back, and but partly because that's my standard. That's where the best reporting is, and that's the most reliable information in the newspaper. I've read day before yesterday that the Yankees lost in Detroit 8-3 in the last game, game in the playoff. Well, I have about 100% confidence that that actually occurred. And other reports in sports that I know that those things actually happened. Those box scores that someone got one hit in for a bat and so forth. As I move toward the front of the newspaper, you know, I have less confidence in what I read and what I see. But it's, as you say, it's not opinion that one should look for and keep track of, but it's physical events and the box scores, so to speak, in politics, the things that actually occur or the results of the votes actually taking, not polling, by the way, which is quite another subject, but focus on the score of the game and eschew opinion, including the opinion of the newspapers you're reading.
Mm-hmm. One other thing that maybe I can hook to this thing about, you know, look for data. I think also that you advise that in one's trying to put together a, you know, your leading economic indicators or whatever it is, sort of keep data streams that you're trying to keep track of as a way of watching the way things are going. I think also your caution is to not to try to take in too much. That there's only so much information that somebody can absorb, and it makes more sense to try to whittle yourself down to some key sources or key sets of data or key sorts of things and not allow yourself to get overwhelmed.
Yes, and that's under the mindset that reads, don't add unless you subtract. You stated quite well, you know, you can get overwhelmed by keeping track of too many things. And so if you're thinking about the future or how many projects you have in your job or whatever, if you can handle four or six comfortably, then a candidate comes along that you don't add that unless you subtract one, which means it makes you think about the candidate if it's strong enough to command your attention, and then you think about what's the weakest one in your current list that you could easily get rid of. And in the process, you know, you improve greatly the quality of what you're keeping track of and the importance of what you're keeping track of. So don't add unless you subtract.
Yeah. It seems to me that looking over these lists, that it seems to be a pretty sound set of principles to use as you're thinking about what's happening now and what's going to happen. I think one could do a lot worse than to try to remind yourself of these things.
Well, a lot of people have said to me, and the book's just come out in the last week, but a lot of people have said to me, gee, some of those things really helped me in life, you know.
Yeah.
Quite apart from trying to figure out the future.
Well, given that, I guess, though, I also want, you know, why do we need why do we need John Nesbitt, or why do we need anybody to come along? And I'm sure that's what people will say. Why do we need you to tell us something which actually, when you think about it, say, well, that kind of makes sense. I should have been able to figure that out myself.
Well, that's true. But if you haven't really figured that out yourself, hopefully it will be helpful that somebody has. And I think taking together, too, that's the other thing, any one of these individually. The really guiding mindset I have is the fourth one, which should be in some ways number one. But it's understanding how powerful it is not to have to be right. Mm-hmm. Having to be right, it really runs a lot of people. Having to be right runs a lot of people in personal relationships. It's certainly politicians are run, many of them, by having to be right, never conceding that they might be wrong, always making the other party wrong. This closes off all growth and learning and openness, and it's just such a negative kind of thing, but most people walk around, you know, having to be right.
Well, looking back to some of the basic points that my understanding that you made in Megatrends, I think some people would say that you did a pretty good job, for example, talking about moving from moving to the information society from the industrial one, the importance of the emerging global marketplace is becoming, say, more important than the national economy. The idea that networking is very important, the rise of importance of the economically speaking of the Southwest as opposed to the Northeast, and all those things. I'm sure some people would say, most people would say, well, that's, yeah, I think you pretty much got that right. Do you, at the same time, I mean, do you find that over time people have wanted to come up to you and said about some particular thing that you said and really give you a hard time about something not being right?
Not so much that as the I've missed it on a number of occasions on the speed of something, of things that I thought would happen, and that's one of the reasons one of my mindsets is the things we expect to happen always happen more slowly.
Yeah.
One of the things I've talked about in my books is, as you know, equal rights for women and women with more responsibility and becoming heads of state and becoming heads of corporations and being important in various professions and so forth. And that is happening, but that's happening so much more slowly than I thought it would happen or that I believe it should happen, actually. And so it's there's a question of how long it takes to for some changes to really fulfill themselves and to be if not dominant so much as to be really truly present in a society, and the advancement of equality of women has been slower than I thought it was going to be, and I get called on that and I acknowledge it completely. I mean, again, I don't have to be right about it. If I had to be right about everything, I would be paralyzed to write about it and publish it. But that's, you know, I know you're very close to the academic community there, mm-hmm. in Urbana, but you know, a lot of academics are reluctant to put their little toe out beyond their data for fear they will be thought they will get something wrong and they won't be right and their colleagues will jump on them or something. But and I see that very widespread in academia, and especially that's true in Europe, where I now live in Vienna. But that's, again, that's just holds clamps down on creativity and on the freedom to think about things and so on. So I have to stick to understanding how powerful it is not to have to be right.
Mm. Our guest this morning, John Nesbitt, he's author of a number of books, with Megatrends in 1982, and then the most recent, this book we're talking about, Mindset, Reset Your Thinking and See the Future, published by Collins. It's just come out. He's a former visiting fellow at Harvard, former visiting professor at Moscow State University, has been faculty member of the Nanjing University in China, serves as a distinguished international fellow with the Institute of Strategic and International Studies in Malaysia, and was the first non-Asian to hold that appointment. He has a number of honorary doctorates in humanities, technology, and science. I'm sure you can find his books either in the library or in the bookstore, including the new one. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Holding with a couple of the points that we've talked about, particularly that things that we expect to happen always happen more slowly, and that while a lot of things change, a lot of things stay constant. If you look, even going all the way back to some of the things that you talked about in Megatrends, do you think that it is the case that now, rather than very big leaps, changes, that as you look ahead, even to the, you know, the next 40, 50, 60 years, maybe, that what we're going to do is we will see a continued kind of development and refinement of essentially the same things. And it's not that we're going to see anything really, you know, the next, one of the things you talk about in the book is the next big thing. Everybody wants to know what the next big thing is. Is it that we aren't really going to see that many next big things anytime soon?
Well, I think there's no next big thing anytime soon. If a next big thing is what is meant by a kind of revolutionary a breakthrough, I've done a study of the timelines, of particularly in technology, of these things, and the breakthroughs, the next big things, come in clusters. One of the great clusters of next big things was, of course, the Industrial Revolution, and we're still perfecting and working and enhancing some of the things that were created then. Just as we were beginning to enter into the 20th century, we had simultaneously almost, the telephone, automobiles, airplanes, electricity, and we spent the 100 years of the 20th century enhancing, extending, perfecting those great next big thing breakthroughs. And then at the end of the 20th century, we started to get involved in some really important breakthroughs in information technology and extraordinarily in biotechnology and nanotechnology and even geopolitically with the new China and so forth. And we will spend, decades after decades as we move through the 21st century in an evolutionary period of evolving, perfecting these great gifts of the end of the last century.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that that you talked about in Megatrends, I think, that has to do with technology and people's acceptance of it, it's a lesson, I think, that people who try to develop stuff to sell to the public continue to have to learn over and over again, and that is, you can build something, you can make some kind of a product, and you can say to the public, this is the greatest thing ever, you're going to love this. Well, if people look at it and if they can't imagine themselves using it, if they don't like it, if they don't want to do what it does, you can tell them it's great and they'll love it, but they're not going to buy it.
Right.
And as I say, I think that's a lesson that corporations continue to learn by trying something and having it not be successful.
Well, one of the biggest mistakes in business that I've witnessed over many, many years is, boy, have I got a swell thing for you, for the customer, and without ever checking with the customer. That's a mistake that's repeated over and over again.
Well, given that, is it possible to make any kinds of, maybe this is getting off in a different area, but make any kinds of really solid conclusions about what it is that people do want and the kinds of things that they want? Is that changing, or is it essentially, in a way, people need to be able to do the same kinds of things that they've always been able to do?
The marketplace is the only place that can tell you that. I mean, that was the great failure of central planning, is that in order to central plan really sensibly, you had to know what the market wanted and what the market would buy and what the market would pay. And, paradoxically, the only way you can find that out is to have a free market, which is contradictory to central planning. And that was the fatal fallacy of central planning. And it's also it's the same today, that the only way you can discover if something's going to work is to put it out there and see what people do. Mm-hmm. I mean, some people can be smarter about that than others and can have an intuitive sense better than others, but really you never know until you put it out and the marketplace tells you.
You do in the new book, in Mindset, in the second half, where you're talking about, the first half is about the tools, about ways of thinking about trends, and then in the second part of the book is about trends. One thing that I'm really interested in having you talk about in this section on culture is that your conclusion, and I'm sure that there are people who would agree, is that we are perhaps, culturally speaking, and this I'm sure affects communications and communication devices, seem to be moving away from words. We're becoming more of a visual culture and less a culture that is based in print.
Well, I put it a little more starkly than that and say this, and I'm just a witness to this, is that a visual culture is taking over the world. And that's at the expense of words. It's not that words will go away. It's just that in the mix of the visual and the literary, if we put it that way, that in that mix there's a shift to the visual away from words, but they'll still be there. We, you know, the whole slow death of the newspaper culture, the advertising moving all over the place to a picture narrative, which was what we had in the cave drawings, right? So return to picture narrative. The colors representing just the color, like the color revolutions politically. Architecture being visual icons led by Frank Gehry and others. So there's so many things that these are the pieces of the picture puzzle that all fit, and the rise of the graphic novel, and in that connection, I learned just before going to press that there would be a graphic narrative of the official 9/11 report, and of course that has since come out. So we have the official the United States report on the 9/11 occurrence is a comic book. So you know, the decline of the novel has been predicted for what, 100 years anyway, but it's certainly losing a lot of blood. If it's not dead, it certainly continues to be in decline. So all of these things kind of fit together, which says to me, as I look at it, that a visual culture is taking over the world, not to mention the fact that globally, with 4,000 or 6,000 languages, whatever it is, visual icons of various kinds can be a common communication versus all of the languages that we're hooking up as we globalize everything.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that there would be people who would be prepared to argue that this is not a good thing.
I hope there are people that would do that.
Well, do you, as you think about something like this, I mean, are you trying to be something of a neutral observer when you're simply saying, well, this is what I see happening, this is the way I see things going, or do you yourself want to say that you feel either that's good or bad? Now, whether one could do anything to reverse the trend, that's something else entirely. But do you yourself in your heart of hearts feel that maybe that's not such a great thing?
Yeah, I tend to avoid value judgments in my books, but my conduct speaks for itself. Notice that I'm still writing books.
Still writing books, yeah.
And they are not graphic narratives. No, I would absolutely lament this. The decline of the literature, the novel, poetry actually is not in decline. That's interestingly a counter. There's a counter wave here of poetry becoming more and more interesting, more and more popular. But you know, sure, I find that upsetting in many ways, but that's not what I'm doing. I'm just trying to describe what's happening, and with the future being embedded in the present, this is likely to continue for some time.
Hmm. We have a caller to talk with. Let's bring him into the conversation here. Line number one, someone listening in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I hope this question is not too trivial. Are you by any chance related to the John Nesbitt of my generation, the famous storyteller?
Well, it's, you know, most people have forgotten about that, but I can only tell you, as a very small boy using a crystal set, I used to listen to stories by John Nesbitt.
Yeah, okay.
And that's what you're talking about. And yeah. Remember when the newsreels, when we used to go to the movies, and
absolutely.
The newsreels, he did, they became newsreel features, stories by John Nesbitt.
Yeah.
I think all the Nesbitts are a Scottish clan, and so we're all sort of related one way or another, but not too directly am I related, but I've known about him since I was a small boy.
Okay, I just had to satisfy my
Well, that's terrific to have someone who remembers that.
Thanks a lot.
All right, well, thanks for the call. Other questions are certainly welcome. If you'd like to call in and talk with our guest, John Nesbitt, author of the book Mega Trends, that was first published in 1982, sold a lot of copies around the world. He has since authored a number of other books, and his new one is titled Mindset, Reset Your Thinking and See the Future, published by Collins. And as we've explained, it's in a sense in two major parts. One is his suggestions for a number of ways of thinking about trends as a way of trying to look ahead and see the way that things are going. And then second part of the book is some of his ideas about indeed where things are going in a number of areas. And we were just talking, in fact, about one of them, this shift to the visual culture. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Just going back to when I was asking you the question about, whether you attached your personal feelings perhaps to some of the trends and whether you thought they were good or bad or indifferent. One, just going back again to the mindsets, the last one does indeed have to do with thinking about the consequences of change.
Yeah, I get a little involved in that.
Yeah.
Right?
But it seems that's a different, well, let me just ask you that out. I mean, as you're thinking about trends, how does this question about, well, what does it really mean if this thing really does happen? I mean, how does that, it seems to me that's something that comes in later in the process and you know, the implications are sometimes difficult to see right at the beginning.
Well, that's what I try to address in talking about the ecology of technology, by which I mean borrowing from nature, that when you introduce new things into a habitat, whether it's a new species or some human intervention of some kind, it changes the relationships in the habitat, and it changes lots of things. But we routinely, as human beings, introduce technology into our own habitats, particularly our workplaces, without really thinking about how that changes relationships with the technology and relationships with each other. I think the most unexamined relationship any of us have is just that, our relationship with technology, our relationship with our cell phone, our relationship with a computer, our relationship with other people by using the technology. I mean, that's pretty unexamined territory, and partly because it's so new. But that's what I mean by don't forget the ecology of technology. Don't forget to think about that, is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with another listener, someone in Mahomet nearby, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I have two questions for you. The first one is sort of goes back to something that's annoyed me a long time, which is when people in political office take responsibility, but there's no consequences to their taking responsibilities, you know, whether it's Hastert or Nixon. And I also like to watch all the political pundit shows, and they never seem to take any, I have no idea how good they are at what they do. So I was wondering, what's your record in terms of your prognostications, your trends, and just so that we know where you come from, how well you've done in the past. And then the second question, because this is something which is up and coming and has just hit us within the last 1 year, and that's the whole concept of portable video players, of which there are now hundreds on the market, and started with the iPod and the PSP, and which is significantly different than having an iPod, because it's a video thing, and it's isolating. So what do you think about that, both in terms of good or bad, but also in terms of is it real? Is it going to last? There's lots of things that come out that sort of die after about a year or so. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, things that come out and die are your. So I'm going to take that one first, that part of it first, because we're in a great shakeup period for media of all kinds that the caller talks about. We don't know how it's going to turn out. It reminds me of the turn of into the 20th century when automobiles, we first started to manufacture automobiles, and we're trying to figure out what the fuel was, you know, how many people they should carry, you know, all of the questions. In the United States, there were 2,700 automobile companies created, and we went through a long shakeout period as we tried to figure this all out, and as some people got good at it and some didn't. We now have four automobile companies in the United States, only two of which are American. Shakeout, we have a similar shakeout period that's maybe not quite as dramatic, but maybe it is, a shakeout period of all of the media and all of the manifestations of what's possible that the caller calls about. So I don't know how this is going to turn out. No one does, but we're in a real shakeout period now. The second part, and the first question he asked was, you know, essentially what it was my record about thinking about the future and what I think about the future. And I'm not a good witness to that. And I let the marketplace decide, and the marketplace buys a lot of my books. So I think that's one measure. But David, you have a copy of the book there?
Yeah, I do.
Financial Times on the back of the jacket has a short message about that, and I'll take that as I'll take that. It's pretty good.
Well, okay. Financial Times says, quote, 20 years ago, John Nesbitt's bestseller Megatrends was published with astonishingly precise predictions. He did not go wrong with a single one, so says Financial Times, a remarkable result if you consider how hard it would be to predict what the year 2025 will be like. Well, I guess we would have to take the fact that, yeah, I think a lot of people felt that you had something to say worth going out and spending the money on the book and have done pretty well in terms of sales of the various books that you've written over the years. I think a lot of people in the business community have given you the thumbs up. So we'll give you that.
I certainly can't decide. I have to let the marketplace decide.
Yeah. Let's go on and talk a little bit about global economics, because I think that a lot of the people who have been interested in what you have written over the years have been people in business who were interested in some kind of economic forecasting, economic trends. You do in the second part of this book, you do have some things to say about China, about Europe. Of course, I'm sure also people want to know about what you think about the United States. And looking ahead in the future, you know, who's up, who's down, what everybody wants to know, obviously, is who are going to be the dominant players in the global economy over the next, 50 to maybe even 50 to 100 years.
Where should we start?
Well, let's start with China, because you have a major section on that, and I know that that's something that you're particularly interested in. You've spent time there, and certainly you're not the only one who believes that there is tremendous potential for China to be a dominant player in the world economy. You just have to look at its size to figure that's a pretty easy prediction to make.
Well, yes, I am, but I also am a whistleblower on the incredible hype that I find in the media in China. You know, all the stories that you know, about how China is going to overtake the United States by Tuesday afternoon. And it's just incredible because it's so far from reality. China today has a, an economy that's short of $2 trillion, even though they recalculated their economy last December and brought it up to almost a $2 trillion. The United States economy is almost 13 trillion and growing at a half a trillion a year. It will be 40 years, even when China growing at 10% a year, even if that keeps up, which is unlikely. But even if that keeps up, it would be 40 years or so, you know, and the U.S. economy is not going to stop growing. So I think we have to keep that in context at the same time, not diminishing the importance of China rising as you know, the great workshop of the world, as the U.S. was and as the Britain was in the Industrial Revolution, and then the United States became the workshop of the world. And in the last half of the 20th century, it was Japan, and then joined later by Korea, the workshop. You know, so now China is the workshop of the world. But and also it's going to be beyond that as they get more and more involved in their own initiatives in technology and design and so forth. But as far as economic, quotes, economic domination, which is, by the way, the vocabulary of yesterday, it's just not in the cards anytime soon.
And at the same time, in keeping with one of your principles that things always happen more slowly than
right.
we expect, you also say that well, we'd expect to see a continued growth in China. So it's certainly important not to be overlooked. You're talking about a continued kind of decline for Europe?
Yeah, Europe, as I said, I live in Europe now, and I'm sort of watching it and experiencing it close up. Europe is, I say the statue of Europe has two hearts and 25 mindsets. The two hearts are beating not in symmetry. One heart is beating for this, for the social model, the European social model, social welfare model, which they everyone seems to want to hang on to. At the same time, there's this this urge for economic supremacy, particularly vis-a-vis the United States. Well, they can't have both, and they'd give lip service to economic reforms, but nothing ever happens. And there's really not any leadership in Europe today, as far as I can tell. And they're on a path, I say rather rudely, I guess, on a path. Europe is, the EU is certainly, to mutually assured decline, and they will keep going down unless they decide to deal with the economic reforms necessary for the kind of economic dynamism that they keep saying they want.
All right, let's talk with someone here in Urbana, where we are, line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
What is kind of future do you see for piracy of intellectual property around the world?
That's an interesting question. It's an important consideration. I think that as we become more and more global, one economy for the whole world, and that's the direction we're going, that the marketplace will handle that, which is demonstrated it does. When megatrends first came out, David, in 82, and in the early 80s when I was going around Asia where it was published, in Taiwan was one of the great pirates. The entrepreneurs on Taiwan were among the greatest pirates of intellectual properties. And, you know, I would go to a book signing, and there would be eight different versions that have been pirated. Now there is no pirating in Taiwan because they started to develop their own economic, their own intellectual properties, passed laws to protect their own, which in turn protected everybody's, and now that is not, that is a non-problem in connection with Taiwan, and steps are starting to be taken in mainland China in the same, in the same regard. So I think that as we all get part of the same marketplace, that the market will take, will take care of this, though some legislation along the way would be helpful.
Yeah, you don't think we have an over-reliance on intellectual property in our own economy, perhaps? I mean, are we giving too much away?
Well, what do you mean giving too much? You, first of all, you said over-reliance, and then you said that we were giving too much away.
Well, I mean, I'm just wondering, you know, people develop software or they develop ideas, and then they usually are executed elsewhere or, you know, pirated and sold by somebody else. You're saying...
Well, I'm saying the marketplace will over time correct that.
I mean,
as people, the Chinese especially, as they start to develop their, they're coming on very strong with intellectual properties, in technology and software and design, and they're starting to, in fact, they've passed legislation already to protect their own intellectual properties, which means they will protect everybody's, just as Taiwan and some other places have.
Okay, well, I hope you're right. Thank you.
Right. So do I.
Well, we have about 5 minutes left here in the program. 333-9455 is the number in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is John Nesbitt, author of the 1982 book Mega Trends and many that have been published since. His ideas have been very interesting to people, in particularly in the business, and they're looking for a forecasting of future economic trends. This new book, the one that we've been here talking about, Mindset, offers what he says are some basic principles for thinking about change and thinking about trends. And one of those being that while many things change, most things stay constant. And another is that things always happen more slowly than we expect them to. And then he goes on and talks about what he sees ahead in a number of areas, including technology and the economies. As we talked about, the economies of China and Europe and so forth. Someone wants to call real quick. We can get him in here before the end. As you do look ahead, again, we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that you said that there, at least for the foreseeable future, there is no next big thing. That
right.
Mostly what we're going to be doing is continuing to refine and work on those areas and those discoveries and those new technologies that we already have.
Mm-hmm.
Do you engage in any really total blue sky kind of thinking? Do you ever engage in that, or does everything indeed go back to the kinds of things that we talked before about the fact that don't go. It's okay to try to make a leap, as you say. You shouldn't be afraid to be wrong, but also when you're making your conclusions, what you want to do is you want to look at data. You want to look at hard information. Mm-hmm. You want to have something to base it on, not just a feeling, but something real to base it on.
Well, the part of the problem of consideration, part of the consideration is you can't know what's going to happen. Because every year, what happens in 2007 is shaped by what happens in 2006 mm-hmm. and 2008 by 2007, and it's all a cumulative thing. You can't know what happens every year. So you cannot know what's out there beyond just a very few years, except in the really large overarching shifts. For example, you could say, well, it appears that for the next number of decades, China is going to be a very important player unless something extraordinary happens. I mean, there's some big shifts, big heavy things that are happening. You can project out, not in detail, but project out quite a ways. But most things you cannot. So the best you can do is just talk about what's going on now. Most people don't know what's going on now to begin with. you talk about what's going on now, it sounds like you're talking about the future often if people don't know.
Right.
And then you push out just a few years ahead, and that's about the best you can do. And, as I say in the book, don't get so far ahead of the parade that people don't know you're in it.
Right. Let's try and talk with at least one more caller, Farina, and this is line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I get what you're saying about how things happen slowly, but if you look at history and how quickly economically deprived Germany turned into Nazi Germany, I'm wondering what are the chances of the same thing happening right here?
Hello. The circumstances are so extraordinarily different. I just don't see the parallels. Germany was economically a basket case, and in fact, it took baskets of money to buy a candy bar. The circumstances are totally different.
So it goes. We go back to your basic idea that really that there aren't very many surprises. So that things just don't happen that way.
Yeah, I think that's so.
Even in I guess the place that most people would point to as being the place where there are surprises, it does happen in new technological developments.
Yes, that's right.
But sometimes that does actually happen, that there is some sort of a leap.
Yeah, but things that directly, I like the way you put it, but things that directly involve human beings and human interplay and human considerations, yeah, they happen slowly.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to have to close there because we've come to the end of the time. My apologies, we have one caller we just can't take. If you are interested in reading this book that we've talked about, it's titled Mindset by our guest, John Nesbitt. It's published by Collins, and you could also, I'm sure, look for his other books, including Megatrends. All of those are, I believe they're all, Megatrends should still be in print, is it?
Still selling, unbelievably.
All right. You can find them, I'm sure, in the bookstore.
Yeah, they're all in print.
All right. Mr. Nesbitt, thanks very much.
Thank you, David. I've really enjoyed it very much.